Welcome to the Seven Figure Leaders podcast. This podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners, and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. And there you'll find the link to apply. Welcome. And today we've got Sam Daughtry, who helped small business owners acquire other businesses. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So give us a bit of background then. How did you get into this world?
I worked in financial services for the best part of maybe 8 or 9 years, I'd say. And then I had an opportunity to get into private equity. Predominantly, my job wasn't so much the transaction management, it was more post-acquisition. So we'd buy a company, I'd go in, work with the management, try and develop the culture, build out reporting, all the fun stuff. And eventually I got more into the transaction management. And after a while, I decided it was probably time to do it myself. I was making other people a lot of money and I wanted to make a bit more myself. So I started buying my own companies up in 2022, back end of 22. And since then, we've launched BuySide Advisory, which is our consultancy business.
Brilliant. And so who are you trying to help and what exactly are you doing for them?
So we're sort of small to mid-market. I would say typically we're working with business owners who have already an established company that would like to acquire a different business, another business. Maybe it's in a different location. Potentially it's for a new service they'd like to bring under their group to offer their existing customers, for example. So, but typically it'd be a business buying another business for whatever reason that may be. We do have the odd entrepreneur who may be exited. We've got one client who sold his business for just over 80 million back in end of 2019. He's 5 years in from his covenants, essentially. So he's kind of back out on the acquisition hunt and acquiring companies. Predominantly I'd say it's business owners looking to buy other businesses, essentially.
Okay. And it's a pretty glamorous idea to go out there and buy other businesses at the moment. There are lots of people talking about it. So for anyone who's kind of not sure or who's heard of it but isn't quite sure what the benefits are, why would someone want to actually go out there and acquire another business and bolt it onto their existing one?
So yeah, very good question. The majority of our clients that want to buy another business will have spent tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds a year on marketing, organic growth. And you have to do that, obviously, to get to a certain point. It's part of the process. But typically, they'll hit a point where they've got cash sat on the balance sheet. It's not really doing anything. You know, they can't continuously chuck money down the same marketing avenues, yielding the same results. You know, sometimes a lot of the clients I've spoken to have said there's like a pond of clients they've got, and there's only so many fish in that pond, and keep chucking money into the same audience isn't necessarily yielding the results. So the majority of people are acquiring to grow for acquisition. And that would typically be, if you're a distributor up north, you might want to have a distribution center down south, or it might be a different product that you can then cross-sell those products to, essentially. So typically it would be for growth purposes. Sometimes it's buying IP, sometimes it's acquiring certain customer bases or talent, but the majority of the time you're just trying to grow your revenue, essentially.
And is there a particular sector that you focus on?
No, we're pretty sector agnostic. There's some that we won't typically go near. Some financial services companies, depending on what the regulatory... My background is financial services, so it makes sense that I do work in the area that I really understand, but some areas with high regulation we don't typically touch. But no, the majority of clients we have are across different sectors, and we've got a brilliant team at BuySide who have bought, one guy was involved with a private equity company. He worked, former KPMG, worked for about 10 years in a private equity company. And in total, he was the MD, he sat on top, and different private equity companies within, under the umbrella of the company he was managing, there was over 250 SPVs. Across multiple sectors. So we're quite sector agnostic, but we do take a look at each individual case, and we'll only really take it on if we feel there's a good success, a chance of success with that client.
And what determines the chance of success? What makes it more likely that you're going to be able to achieve those results?
Typically, you know, obviously you have to have, you spoke earlier about a lot of people talking about M&A. As much as the gurus will lead you to believe that it's easy to buy a business with no money down, the reality is you do need cash. And if you've got cash and you've got credibility, then typically a bank or a seller will be more than happy to talk with you or lend, obviously, cash to you if that's what they require. But quite often it's actually having their own house tidy, you know, if they've got the right platform to actually acquire. Because people sometimes want to merge businesses, or it's just buy a standalone company and it forms part of their group. And that will definitely dictate success, essentially, because I think it's something like 40 or 51% of mergers don't work out. They just don't work out. That doesn't mean they fail. It just might mean that they haven't had the impact they wanted when they took on that acquisition. So it's kind of buyer readiness, really, I'd say, is what we're looking for.
Buyer readiness as opposed to seller readiness.
Yeah, from our side, obviously, first of all, and then the target. You need two. You need motivated buyer, motivated seller.
Yeah.
You have to have that. But from our side, when we're taking on a client initially, you know, we've got someone that's motivated to buy, they've got the right reasons to buy, and they've got the right platform to acquire.
And diving into that in a bit more detail, right platform to acquire. Okay, so like you said, they've got the cash, you know, they want to do an acquisition. What else do they need in their own business to actually maximize the chances of having a successful acquisition?
Certainly management is something that we always look at and we talk about, and capacity to do that. Now, people acquire management teams, obviously, and people will acquire companies for the ability or you know, services that particular company will have. But definitely management is one that we pay close attention to. Have they got the skill sets in the chosen target, acquisition targets they've got? And you know, can they handle it essentially? Because it's obviously quite a big bit. But everyone acquires for different reasons. You know, it's not set in stone. The other one I typically say is how relevant it is as well. You know, if someone's owns a plumbing company and now they want to buy an accountancy practice, you know, you have to kind of question why. But typically, yeah, there's very few scenarios where you'd say no, it's just not going to work. But we like to understand. For our side, it helps us service our clients a lot better if we really understand their motivation, essentially.
Yeah. And so on the other side of things then, what does seller readiness mean to you?
So that means, like we said earlier, a motivated seller, certainly. But when, you know, at the best businesses, if anyone's listening to this and they're thinking about selling a company, our best advice would be prepare years in advance, have correct reporting over a period of time. Make sure you've got management accounts, budgets, cash flow forecasts. You've got a pricing model. So, you know, it's very easy to understand how you price a job and making sure you make profit on it on every individual job that you do, you know, depending on what you do, obviously. Having the right management in place, you know, most people would want something, or certainly most of our clients would want a business that's, I don't want to say plug and play, but isn't heavily reliant on the owner. Standard operating procedures, making sure you've got procedures in there so it's easy to understand what you do. But really try to simplify the business. And when you're simplifying the business, make sure it's the key drivers that really stand out. So it's very evident to a buyer the benefits of buying that particular company.
Yeah.
Key ones, I'd say.
It sounds like you're trying to sell what I do.
it's ideal when we have someone like you on the other side that have been with you. Everything's prepared, right? You've got it all prepared.
Exactly. But exactly what you just said. So having solid reporting, making sure that you've got forecasts and budgets in place, making sure that everything makes sense, that the drivers are all broken down clearly and that any buyer can see exactly what's driving the business and what the impact of those is over the, you know, the expected impact of changing those over the next few periods is going to be. So changing path a little bit. So what's the process? So you start with deal sourcing, you go through, you find an offer, you agree the offer, heads of terms, go through due diligence, get the deal signed. So do you manage that whole process from start to finish for your clients?
Yes, we do. The only thing we don't do at the moment is financial due diligence and legal due diligence. Even though we have got the capabilities for the financial side, it's not something we're offering internally at the moment, although we can obviously recommend people. On top of that as well, some of our clients require debt advice and debt advisory work. And we sometimes, you know, we don't offer the advice on debt advice, essentially. But what we will do is point in the right direction of people who do that. So there's a few brokers we work with that are very good. We've got some tier one lenders on our books that I personally work with when buying companies. And, you know, we can introduce people, but essentially we're not setting it up or structuring it for them. Other than that, we do everything.
So your role is basically the one driving the whole process throughout the whole thing, and then being that touch point for both the buyer and the seller.
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that.
And so out of all of that, I mean, I can see why someone would want to work with someone like you, because there's a lot to take on and manage, especially as your clients are going to be looking after their own businesses whilst all this is going on. What is kind of the most challenging part of that process, and the bit that you find that you have to get the most involved, or that takes the most effort, the hardest to get through to the next stage?
So the most effort would be deal origination. I always use the rocket analogy. A rocket uses 40% of its fuel on takeoff. And it's quite similar with an M&A transaction. You know, getting going really into a deal requires, you know, to look at dozens of companies. And typically, you know, everyone talks about off-market opportunities. I do agree with that, although there's some advisors and some brokers and corporate finance houses that are very realistic. Good, you know, they know how to sell a business. They know how to manage the expectations of their clients, and they prepare the business to be sold, like we just spoke about, right? That's what we're looking for. So I'd say in terms of the hardest part in terms of effort is deal origination and going through those businesses, having those conversations. And you're right, what we do is we take dozens of hours of work and conversations and sifting through these opportunities away from our clients. They're not having to worry about that. We only come to them once we've got the right opportunities. In terms of skill, so different to effort, obviously, but in terms of the biggest challenge with skill, it would more than likely be, in my opinion, things like evaluation work, understanding the key drivers about, you know, how, what generates revenue, understanding to structure a deal. Because I always say price is deal structure is as important as price.
Yeah.
The terms that you set for that. So it's understanding the business. It's also knowing what to look for. It's really that experience of knowing what to look for and what headaches we can save our clients down the line.
Absolutely. And so do you value the businesses as well?
Yeah, we do valuation work. Yeah, deal structuring, offer sequencing. We do all of that.
And so when it comes to valuations, for example, how do you, let's say you work with one client who runs a construction company, and then your next client's a marketing agency, your next one's, you know, someone that owns care homes or whatever. How do you know what the kind of the market multiples are in each of those sectors at any different point, so that you can get an accurate valuation?
Yeah, very, very good question. So first of all, we keep, you know, a finger on the pulse with the market. We understand what multiples are out there at the moment. And that's always relevant to size, first of all. And I'll give you a good idea. For example, you know, there's companies that might be 5 million turnover compared to 500 million. And a 500 million pound business is more than likely going to get a higher multiple, more established. Someone's got to pay more for it. So we do look at size and industry. Different industries do warrant different multiples, which we keep an eye on. We have different software and analysis that we can pull from the, you know, mainly in the UK and the States, but Europe as well, where we can really understand what multiples are on the market. Ultimately, a business is only worth what someone's prepared to pay. And, you know, funny enough, different sectors have different valuation models as well.
Yeah.
So where one might have a valuation, you know, multiple of profit, another one might be a multiple of revenue. A lot rarer, but things like estate agents, letting agents, quite often it'll be a multiple of like the book value, or it might be, you know, a multiple of revenue or whatever it looks like. So it does depend on the industry as well.
Yeah. Okay. And when you're actually negotiating the deal, and you know, you found a target company, you like it, you know what you think it's worth, you know what you're going to make an offer for. In terms of actually getting the negotiation over the line and to the next stage, what are the main challenges that you face there? You know, I would imagine, well, I know that you often struggle with unrealistic expectations on the sell side. And how do you kind of overcome those differences in views?
You can't always overcome them, and that's why it's really important. If you're looking to sell your business, you have the right advisor. You know, it's very difficult to, you know, you turn around to your wife and say, "I just spoke to an advisor, and we're going to get £5 million for our business." Tells the wife. The wife's already spending it, and then you actually go back and say, "Actually, this business is only worth £1.5-2 million." It's very difficult emotionally. It takes an immense amount of emotional discipline to actually have a realistic expectation on your business. everyone overvalues their company. Small business owners all want £1 million. So the old saying is, you know, you times how many shareholders are by £1 million, and that's the valuation they're going to give you. But this is where you need deal flow, in my opinion. You need a few opportunities. There are always going to be people that want more money than what it's actually worth. So you have to have multiple options. We get a lot of people actually that we submit an offer to, and it doesn't quite meet, or you know, we're not in a ballpark of valuation, should we say? So there's no point in continuing the conversations. And then a year later, you get a phone call, and they say, "Oh, hi, I've had a think," you know, and it happens all the time. There's people I spoke to 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago that still haven't sold their business, and it's probably the number one thing that stops people from selling their business. So just deal
with the expectations.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'd probably say it's unrealistic expectations, or the business just is not ready. It's just unsellable. It's too reliant on the owner. They haven't prepared the business properly.
Yeah. And then once you've got that agreed, and then you've got the terms of the deal agreed, how reluctant are owners to accept, you know, a decent chunk of deferred consideration?
It's becoming more common. Deferred is something that more and more people are doing. In actual fact, a lot of the time, depending on the company and why they're buying, but a lot of our clients will, even if they had 100% of the money to invest, they'll put 80, 90% down and keep back 10, 20% over, you know, a year, 18 months, 2 years, for example, just to protect their risk a little bit. But it is quite common. And again, that is certainly a stumbling block. Sometimes I've seen, we pre-qualify all our clients, so we know affordability isn't an issue. But sometimes when they are stretching the purchase price, you're having to get a little bit creative in how you structure this deal. But most people would be happy 70, 80, 90% upfront and the rest deferred.
Yeah.
Okay. Experience.
And then deals all agreed, heads of terms, then the due diligence starts. How many do you see fall through at that stage?
Quite a lot. I'd probably say... for us, it's a lot better at buy-sell advisory success rate, because it's like a good salesman. You know, they only ask for the money when they know they've got the sale, they've done the work, they don't, you know. So we are kind of quite similar. We're not going to progress with a deal that we're arming and ahhing about whether it is going to complete. And we try to do as much upfront as we possibly can. Inevitably, you know, we're not doing the in-depth due diligence. And quite often, you know, you get to understand the seller, and you get to understand, you know, you really get to build a relationship with these people. And when you really trust these people and you see how genuine they are, there's a far higher chance that deal is going to complete. Sometimes when you're a bit unsure and they've been a bit sheepish around certain questions, and, you know, so I think a lot of it comes down to just making sure at the start. But in my previous life in private equity, I'd probably say 40% completed at heads. I'd now say we're far higher, probably 80, 90%. And the great thing about what we try to do is we don't stop deal origination. We don't go back to the start. We have other opportunities that are kind of in the pipeline for us to pursue straight away. So it does happen, though. It does happen.
Yeah, I see. Brilliant. And then getting the deal over the line. So you go through legal due diligence, financial due diligence, tax due diligence, and then actually getting the deal over the line on the last day. And working out those final details. You said that you don't do the financial due diligence, but do you calculate the kind of working capital that's going to be required and the cash on closing, all that stuff, or do you let the accountant do that?
Yeah, we do. We have an estimated working capital calculation, again, depending on the deal structure, at the indicative offer stage, actually. So we, on the indicative offer, we're putting price, terms and deal structure, target completion date, handover process or period, should I say. And then we're also talking about working capital. Inevitably, that changes right towards the end. You know, debtor book changes, cash swings, you name it, you know, it all makes a difference. But we do that towards the end. Again, a lot of our clients will have accountants that will be overseeing these deals, and they have got that advice anyway. But we either do it or certainly support with it. And worst case, we'd overlook it and give our opinion on it as well.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Well, that's a really good overview of the process. And one thing we haven't touched on is the business valuation itself. So for anyone who isn't sure kind of generally how business valuations work, I know there are lots of different ways that you can answer this, but perhaps you could give a bit of an overview of how you would value a business. And I know, like you said, you know, depending on the industry, it can be a multiple of revenue, it can be multiple of EBITDA, it can be based on book value, but kind of a general theme, perhaps.
Yeah, not a problem at all. So the most common would be a multiple of profit. Typically, it'd be EBITDA or adjusted EBITDA. There's a lot of stick about how adjusted EBITDA is, because what does that mean? But typically it'll be a multiple of profit. And then what we're looking at that point is industry standards and multiples. You know, so we're saying what is a fair price, but what is the current rate in the industry? And what we'll usually do is we'll do like a weighted 3-year average. So we'll go back across 3 years, we'll average out the profit. And then from there, we'll come up, we'll apply a multiple to the average of the last 3 years. And then essentially, that's one option, obviously. And essentially from that, we're then looking at what costs are associated with the business that wouldn't be there post-acquisition. For example, currently, does the owner own the building and pays minimal rent or no rent at all? Well, if you're not buying the property, then that's something you have to adjust for, because that is going to be a cost the business is going to need afterwards. Same again with director salary. A lot of people would take minimal amounts of salary, multiple dividends. So you kind of look at that and what replacement cost would be for true profitability. You get pension contributions, you get family members on the payroll, you get credit cards that the director uses, basically all sorts of different things that you kind of have to go through. But typically, in its most simple form, it'd be a multiple of profit and then working out the true profitability post-acquisition.
Okay. And then once we've got that, let's say it's 4x adjusted EBITDA.
Yep.
Do we then add on the balance sheet on top of that, or does that 4x EBITDA include the balance sheet and cash?
It depends on, again, what it is, what the deal structure is. Quite often it will just be, and it again depends on the sector as well. For example, I've just helped someone buy their business partner out in gold bullion, and they had like 4 million quid's worth of gold on the balance sheet. And some was attributed towards clients and sales that had happened, but that's obviously a huge amount of value that has been added into that business. So often when you're looking at the balance sheet, it'll be surplus cash.
Yeah.
Definitely be on top. But if the assets are essential to the day-to-day operations, then typically you wouldn't include the assets of the business, stock, machinery. It would just be a multiple of profit. But again, depending on what that balance sheet holds and what it is, then sometimes it can be on top. But definitely surplus cash. If it's a no cash, no debt deal, then surplus cash will always go back to the seller as part of the purchase price.
I see. So you do, let's say 4x EBITDA, and then you do like a normal version of the balance sheet. So what's required to operate the business day to day, that would be included in the 4x EBITDA. But then anything on top of that, let's say they've got, property, or they've got lots of inventory or lots of fixed assets over and above what they need to run the business, or lots of cash, then that would be on top of the 4x EBITDA.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. Yeah. So we did a deal. I bought a business about 20 months ago. And we bought, it was a really solid business, 32, nearly 33 years old at the time we bought that company. And we had a multiple of profit. I had the property. So we also paid for the X. We took on the money. Property was worth about 600 grand, and we took on about 250,000 left on the mortgage. So we actually paid the additional value of the property on top of the multiple, and there was surplus cash on that as well. So the surplus cash went on top after our working capital calculations as part of that. So yeah, it wasn't just a multiple of profit. It was, in addition, the property value minus the mortgage plus surplus cash.
I see. And then when it comes to working capital and cash, is it a level of normal working capital plus a level of normal cash that we include in the 4x EBITDA?
A buffer, we always say, is essential. What that is different for every deal naturally, but yeah, we'd say here's a normalized working capital amount that we want left behind, and a bit of a buffer just to make sure, because who knows what's around the corner, right?
A buffer in cash.
Yeah. Typically we'd say it can't just be to the penny. We always try to negotiate for our clients a little bit extra, just to give a bit more breathing space essentially.
Brilliant. Okay, perfect. Well, I think that's all very clear, and you've done a great job of explaining that. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to cover or that you'd like to share?
Not really, no. I think anyone that's looking to buy a business, just understanding it's a huge opportunity at the moment to acquire. There's lots of people looking to sell. Tax increases, a retiring generation of business owners. There really are some good opportunities out there to acquire. And of course, if anyone wanted to have a chat, I'd be more than happy for no application video call or coffee and do that from there. But no, it's been really enjoyable, Tom.
Great. Well, pleasure to have you on the podcast, and we'll make it very easy for anyone who is interested in having a conversation with you to contact you. We'll put your LinkedIn and your email address and stuff under the show notes. And yeah, wishing you all the best with the, you know, your acquisition journey and for your clients over the rest of the year.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for your time, mate.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. On that page, you'll find the link to apply.